Welcome to this week's HPS Cast. I am your host, Colbert Cannon, and let me tell you a little bit about HPS and what you're listening to today. HPS is a global investment firm. We manage over $60 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. I sit in the private credit side of the house, and I spend time finding opportunities to deploy our capital into a range of interesting situations, mergers and acquisitions, refinancings, etc. The central premise of our show is simple. We are entrusted as stewards of capital by our investors, and we entrust that capital to management teams to help drive value creation. This podcast is intended to talk to key relationships of HPS about how they got to where they are today, and how those experiences help them drive value creation on a day-to-day basis for themselves and for their stakeholders. This podcast will introduce those business leaders to you, our listeners, and it is our hope that through those interviews, you will get a little bit of a better sense of who we, HPS, are through the lens of our key constituents internally and externally. Our guest today is someone I've known for over 25 years, which I'll note means I've spent more time in my life knowing this man than not. He was in the ROTC program as a college undergraduate and served our country as an officer in the U.S. Navy, deployed on the USS Benfold, primarily in the Arabian Gulf. After leaving the Navy, he attended Stanford's Graduate School of Business and left Palo Alto with a job in the principal investing business at the investment bank Goldman Sachs in New York. He then spent 3 years at Silverpoint Capital, a credit-oriented special situations investment firm, with time both in Greenwich and in London. And in London, he led the European public investment business focused on a range of special situations and restructurings. In 2007, he joined what was then Highbridge, part of J.P. Morgan, to help build what became Highbridge Principal Strategies. And under his stewardship, as one of the governing partners of HPS, he built the direct lending practice from a small private credit business to the global platform it is today. Without any further ado, let me introduce this week's guest, Mike Patterson, governing partner of HPS.
Thanks for having me, Colbert, and you're a brave man to take this on.
So, Mike, I hope you don't mind. I dusted off your CV, so let me first give our listeners a little bit of your background. Your grandfathers were medical doctors in the Navy and served in the Naval Reserve for many decades. You graduate high school and you make your way from Pensacola to Harvard with help from the Navy's ROTC program, along the way walking onto the Harvard tennis team. You must have taken your opportunity with ROTC seriously because upon graduation, you received the Admiral James Holloway Award. And for those who don't know, this award is given annually to the top national graduate of the Naval ROTC. Think of it as kind of like the Heisman Trophy, but for Navy guys. So just a few months after being at Harvard, you graduate and you're an officer leading a team of sailors on the USS Benfold. Tell me about where you're deployed and what was your mission?
Sure. So the Benfold, it's an Arleigh Burke destroyer. We were homeported in San Diego. I actually met the ship in Bahrain. So my first job, I flew from 3 or 4 months of division officer training in Newport, Rhode Island, got on one of those, I don't believe it was a jet. I think we might have flown a prop plane literally halfway around the world with, looked like Indiana Jones stopping at, every
2 or 3 hours. You're going from Newport to Bahrain.
Yeah. I get on a helicopter, I land on a ship, and there are 25 people from 18 to early 40s standing at attention and walk up and say, okay, sir, what do we do?
Yeah.
Like, that was my division.
Yeah. And, you know, if you think about, I always talk to people in our line of work that half of what you learn is you get thrown into situations you don't really know what you're doing and you're forced to figure it out. That's probably the ultimate example of that. You're half the age of some of the people you're commanding. How do you make that all work?
You usually don't.
Yeah.
And then you figure out the ones that eventually make it work, acknowledge that they aren't, and then allow themselves to be taught by the people that actually know what they're doing.
Yep.
And there's a very rigid distinction in the military between a sort of white-collar, blue-collar, the officers and the enlisted folks. And the reality is the technical knowledge and the experience – almost all of it resides in the enlisted ranks.
Of course.
And I think one of the advantages, frankly, of not coming from a service academy is that I showed up and knew I didn't know a lot.
Yeah, the appropriate humility.
That was helpful.
Yeah.
You know, I had nothing to defend.
Yeah.
I said,
it's like
at
an investment bank when like the analyst actually know what's going on and
right.
The MD has no clue.
Exactly.
That's the same
exactly.
thing. Yeah.
And so the quicker you acknowledge that and you don't want to ingratiate yourself with your chief, but establish a relationship where they know that you respect their knowledge and you want their advice and where they can establish a bit of a mentorship relationship of, I'm going to teach this young man how to be a good officer, then you're off to a really good start.
And so then tell me about the mission. Where were you actually deployed?
This would have been right at the turn of the year between 97 and 98. There was an earthquake, I believe, in Turkey or Syria, maybe even northern Iraq. And there was – at the time, we were enforcing UN sanctions against the Iraqi regime. And historically, the Iraqi regime apparently had funded itself by still selling oil but exporting it via trucks over into Turkey or Syria where they just switch the license plates or whatever they do. And it was like a very well-oiled machine, pun intended. But the earthquake and the natural disaster in the northern part of Iraq had forced them to reroute a lot of their shipments. So our main mission was to lurk around the northern part of the Persian Gulf and make sure that there wasn't a tremendous amount of smuggling going on. And at first there wasn't. And then all of a sudden there was
a lot. Yeah. Amazing. Your title was damage control officer.
Right. Still is.
Do you ever look back as a credit investor and think that's ironic? It is literally your job today.
All the time. Yeah. I actually still have the hat that says damage control officer and I'll bring it to the office.
Yeah, you should. So it comes time to leave the military and you make a decision to go back to business school. How'd you think about that versus the range of options in front of you?
I felt like for me, I actually needed the education. No small part, I think, of business and economics is just understanding what people mean, what the jargon means and what its implications are. And so that was a big focus of mine in business school was literally the business school education. Not for a minute did I think of networking. I didn't think of taking time off. For me, it was a pretty serious endeavor and a chance to try to get up the curve and learn some of what all my colleagues had been doing for the last 4 years.
When you look back now on that, 20 years ago or whatever, was that the right choice? Like, do you think that's money well spent?
Yeah, those counterfactuals are impossible to prove one way or the other. I think it was.
Yeah.
I mean, I did learn a lot, and I actually think I also chose the right place. I think one of the amazing insights of Stanford Business School is they very subtly play down all the competitive aspects of a bunch of successful people. And they reinforce that various ways. Like they won't release grades to recruiters. Mm. Every class votes on that, by the way. You show up and they say, are you going to be the first class that releases grades? It's sort of a bit of a sham vote. But of course, everyone says, no, we're collaborative. We believe in each other. It's a huge team. We want to learn from each other. And I think that they really wisely take for granted that everyone cares anyway because they do. Yeah. You wouldn't have the kind of resume
that works,
to get
there. That works if you accept the right people.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I think they do. And I think they look for people that have been motivated and been successful and bring them in, realize they're probably competitive. So totally downplay that, realizing you can't change them really. Yeah. They're going to be competitive and emphasize all the collaborative aspects. And that was huge for me because while I took literally every accounting class I could get my hands on in business school, I actually learned accounting from two roommates who gave me the training binders, one from Bain & Company and the other one from Blackstone. Like that was the relevant part. And I don't think that would have happened at a different place with a different culture.
So before you end up helping build HPS, you've managed to gain some pretty valuable experience with top investment firms in the industry. First, you ended up at Goldman Sachs right out of Stanford Business School with a less than conventional resume. And for those who aren't familiar, the vast majority of associates at large investment banks spend time before business school doing some form of finance. Can you talk to me about how you managed that transition and how you took advantage of that opportunity?
I think it was definitely, drinking from a fire hose. I really appreciate they took a chance on me, without a doubt. Like I did not have a traditional background. I think I had been able to, to leverage some of the Stanford network to get really interesting practical opportunities in school and during the summer to do stuff on the investing side. So I wasn't a complete neophyte, but without a doubt, I didn't have the 2 years in banking and 2 years at another PE firm and then business school and then back to PE. I didn't have that resume. And so I do appreciate the chance that they took.
I mean, you had managed 25 men intercepting, oil smugglers in the Arabian Gulf, which is its own thing.
It is its own thing. Yeah. And, the way I like to translate that is I did have some experience making decisions under uncertainty.
That's
like,
right.
Without
That's
a
right.
doubt.
They weren't worried about that. I'm always interested in how people find opportunities. So at a point, you leave Goldman and you go to Silver Point.
Right.
How'd you get that call?
Right. And it's a little more complicated than that. I was not looking to leave Goldman. I got a call on a random Wednesday, having been there for more than a year and less than 2 years. And my assistant says, excuse me, Mike, Steve Schwartzman's on your line, which I thought was a joke. I thought it was a prank. I thought it was probably you, someone calling to basically harass me at work.
Not a crazy perspective.
I didn't think so.
Yeah.
I pick up the phone and it is Steve Schwartzman who says—
CEO of Blackstone Group, for those of you who aren't paying attention.
Literally on the line. Hey, Mike, heard great things about you. There's no way that's true. Yeah. But why don't you come up to Midtown? Would love to sit down and have a chat. And at this point, I was trying to suss out whether this was real or not. I said, okay, like next week. No, today. Why don't you come up to Blackstone? So I did. I left and hopped in a cab and went up to Blackstone, and that started the exploration. So it wasn't proactive on my part thinking about other things.
Now, with the benefit of hindsight, how did Stephen Schwartzman hear good things about you? Do we know?
No. Yeah. And I'm still not sure that's true.
Yeah.
But he is like a very, very capable negotiator, and that was a good way to start.
Yeah, exactly. I think fully disarmed.
He probably had a list.
Yeah.
I was probably the 14th person on it.
Yeah.
The other 13 said no, yeah. And they said, Dear Mr. Patterson, I've heard great things about you.
Amazing. All right. So we end up at Silver Point.
But even that piece of it, so I would go down the road with Blackstone, and they were very convincing. I was going to join Blackstone. Late in the process, they had had a number of people that left the firm for the first time. And I asked, and I look back, and it just seems really arrogant, and yet it was a great question. I said, look, you've had a lot of people at my level and the level right above. I don't mean senior partners who have made so much money they don't want to work anymore. A lot of people leave all of a sudden. Would you mind if I talked to one or two of them? And they said, sure, go ahead. So I called one of them who had gone to Silver Point. And that's how I ended up connecting with Silver Point. We talked for a little bit, and then he said, you cannot take the Blackstone offer. You have got to come here. Let me tell you why. And he was really convincing.
So you continue your journey. You land at Silver Point Capital in 2004, and Silver Point at the time was a leading distressed credit hedge fund, meaning they primarily bought and sold levered loans and bonds in public and private credit markets. What kind of things were you doing at Silver Point, and what kinds of investments were you making at that time?
I think it would have described itself as primarily event-driven or distressed.
Yep.
Like that's how it had cut its teeth. Had made really smart investments, smart nuanced investments in Enron, and that was starting to resolve itself. And on the back of that, the fund was growing and expanding. It had a really nascent direct lending. We didn't even really use the term back then, but direct lending business. Single pool of capital, but this was making illiquid loans into complicated situations, things that didn't fit naturally onto bank balance sheets. And because of the firm's leadership, which had run bank balance sheets, they knew what didn't fit and what did, and so could be very targeted in that effort.
At what point in that did you get tapped to go over to London?
Late 2005, there were three or four people in the London office, and they asked me to go over to sort of bolster the team. They wanted a senior analyst there, and they wanted somebody, I think, to help make kind of in-theater decisions along with the guy that they had initially asked to go over and start it.
How different was that experience from what you had been doing at Silver Point?
Very different. I mean, we were building a business largely from scratch. It is a absolutely amazing experience, both as an investor and a manager. I think on the investing side, everything you had to evaluate from first principles. Like as a credit investor—
What do you mean by that?
We take so many things for granted in the lingua franca of credit in the US. When I say, yeah, that's a secured note, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you don't know what I mean when I say that's a secured note and it's in Germany or maybe it's in France or maybe it's a FinCo with the double Luxco going into Italy.
Yeah.
Those are all very
it's
different
secure,
things.
But by what? And by if you what? Ever have to enforce, how does it work and
exactly.
all of that?
Exactly. Yeah. What's the leakage?
And as you say, you've got to go back to first principles.
Really first principles and get into what does that mean and then how do I price that?
Yeah.
Now, I think one of the great challenges in Europe is that many people don't do that extra bit of work to acknowledge the nuance and then price it. It is – things can be priced with a little bit of a kind of an even keel when it argues for real difference.
Well, and there's an interesting timing dynamic in that too because you were building that business at a time of pretty benign economic,
Absolutely.
If not powerful growth. And none of those things matter when everything's going up and to the right.
That's
like those
exactly
are only
right.
issues in a, when everything falls apart,
That's
which
exactly right.
was about to happen but hadn't happened yet.
Yeah. And that can be frustrating on the way up when you do a lot of work and you're identifying nuance and trying to price nuance and – just losing because other people will pay
because
more
somebody's
for
ignoring.
It.
Yeah, interesting. When you move on from Silver Point and join up with then Highbridge, how did that call come in and how did you find your way there?
Maybe we should subtitle this Michael Patterson's Journey, a series of cold calls, because I get a cold call from Scott Kapnick. Same thing. Heard great things about you.
CEO of HPS.
CEO of heard great things about you. We should meet. I want to talk to you about what I'm doing. So Scott was leaving after a great career where he ran the investment bank at Goldman and was joining Highbridge to help build out an illiquid investment side. And one of the big themes in the alternative investment universe at the time was convergence, whether PE funds were going to take over hedge funds or hedge funds going to take over PE.
We're in 2007?
We're in 2000. This is late 06.
Yeah.
The conversations first started. It might have been early 07. It was cold.
Yeah.
Remember that. And he put forth a really compelling proposition. I think he's a good negotiator and a very intuitive leader. And he said, Mike, you can do great things at Silver Point. You'll make great, interesting investments. You can have an interesting career. You will always be an employee. Always. Doesn't matter how much money you make. Doesn't matter what you run. You will be an employee. Would you like a chance to come help build a business, as a real partner? And that to me was really compelling, frankly, on an emotional level, because I would actually give up a lot for the opportunity to do that.
And what was Highbridge when you joined?
I'll get the numbers wrong, but I'd say it was a $16 or $18 billion multi-strat hedge fund. And its history was in the liquid markets, without a doubt. But like many hedge funds of that size, they took a really modest amount of capital and were comfortable investing it in illiquid things. So of the $18 billion, were there $500 or $800 million that were invested in illiquid markets? Sure. But a big piece of the business was convertible arbitrage. A big piece of the business was equity long short. And a big piece of the business was a quantitative trading strategy. And it had been purchased by JP Morgan in 2005. And part of the attraction for us, we had seen the power of harnessing the deal flow at an investment bank in order to create really interesting investment opportunities. We had also seen the limitations and the conflicts that come from that. And this setup where you're not part of the bank, you're an asset management. It's third-party money. It's not bank balance sheet. Our thesis was, we think we are particularly well-positioned given our history to capture maybe 70% of the benefits of being inside a bank. And this structure maybe doesn't have 10 or 20% of the conflicts, 10 or 20% of the problems. And in that case, this is a really great setup and we feel particularly well positioned to capitalize on it. That was the idea.
And so then when you executed against that plan, how would you describe the business you started then and what's it evolved into today?
Yeah. Looking back, I think one of the things we've done really well is not stick to a business plan. I know that sounds hilarious, but it's
– you have to be adaptive.
You've got to be dynamic.
Yeah.
You've got – what you wrote on a cocktail napkin in 2007 might not be interesting in 2013. And if you're stuck on the cocktail napkin business plan, you're not going to be optimizing for your investors, for the employees.
Well, in 2007's plan didn't contemplate 2008, presumably.
That's right.
And there's the old Mike Tyson line, everybody has a plan until they're punched in the face.
That's
and
right.
You have to react appropriately.
Funny because it's true.
Yeah.
So, the business, I think the original cocktail napkin, we had distressed debt, we had real estate, thinking real estate private equity, we had private equity, and we had mezzanine. That was the original cocktail napkin. And if you looked at Goldman's prop businesses, you would say, wait, I've seen that cocktail napkin. That rhymes. Without a doubt, that's where we took a lot of our ideas because that was our history.
Yeah. And so 2008 happens and then obviously the business has grown the way it has today.
Yeah.
How would you describe the HPS you have today and in particular the business unit you run?
Yeah. So in 2009, as public markets started to recover, it looked like a really opportune time to dust off the playbook that I had seen used really successfully at Silver Point and that I assume they dusted off a playbook they had used really successfully at Goldman. So there's a strain of DNA there. But the idea was on the back end of a financial crisis, or doesn't have to be a crisis, a recession, there's a window of time when banks are so focused on cleaning up their balance sheets and righting the wrongs of yesteryear that they can't focus on new business and originating new loans. And if you can step in with appropriately illiquid capital, you can create really compelling risk-adjusted returns in that origination business and direct lending.
And when you say appropriately illiquid capital, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, and that was one of our initial insights is, people had done that in hedge fund format with quarterly liquidity or six-month liquidity historically.
A model that works until it doesn't.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Creates opportunities for others over time.
Yeah.
We insisted that it should be a private equity structure, but it should be a private equity. It doesn't need to be a 10-year private equity structure. The loans aren't 10 years. You can appropriately size it. And we thought 5 years, 6 years, something like that was the right amount of time. Most of these loans, mature. Most of them were paid off inside 3 years, but mature at 4, 4.5. So that was the structure we put in place. And if you go back and look at our initial pitch books, we say explicitly, we believe this is a 24 to 36 month opportunity. History suggests that 2 to 3 years from now, we are going to be blown out of the water on pricing by banks flooding back into this space after they've repaired their own balance sheets and are able to lend more aggressively.
So 10 years on, that was wrong.
We were wrong.
Why was that wrong?
I think the regulatory reaction, I don't just mean national regulators, but let's include Basel III, just the change in bank business models in reaction to some of the regulatory changes post-crisis have made the space just a lot less profitable. Like at no point did any regulator outlaw the ability of banks to do non-investment grade lending. I mean, that's just not true. And I think people sometimes in their own pitch books like to spin a yarn that somehow banks aren't allowed to do what we do. Nor they absolutely are allowed to do it, but it is capital inefficient. It's inefficient in terms of, you know, the people can't be repurposed for other things very well. And they've gone and found much more higher ROE business models in and around the space, like lending to direct lending funds, where they lend against a collateralized pool of loans. They've just developed other ways to do this business that are really, really efficient for them. And so they have not flooded back in. And so the space has grown really dramatically.
As the business has grown, assets have grown over the years. We've grown in people too. You've hired more people than basically anybody I know. What are your learnings out of that? You've managed growth over a 10-year period. And I can say, as somebody who's worked at HPS, turnover always happens in our business, but I think we've done a pretty good job of hiring people. Like, it doesn't feel like we've had, you know, sort of the mistakes that you see sometimes. How do you do that?
Yeah. First of all, I appreciate that because I think, one, we work really hard at it. And I don't think there's any flippant hiring, that's not a system that works well. Although, even though maybe we've done better than most, like, we have not had any horrible misses where we've had somebody that I think actually makes the whole worse, you know, actually detracts from the performance of others. But we have, of course, we've had people that we didn't think contributed as much as we hoped. Like, that has happened. I go back to references. I think a lot of times, particularly if you're talking mid-level or senior level, the standard hiring practice of, you know, we do an interview and a case study and 4 more interviews and then maybe a more culture-focused interview. And then at the very end, hey, do you have 2 or 3 references? Like, we'll give them a call. And frankly, it's difficult if you don't have a personal connection with those references for them to tell you a very truthful one. I like to flip that on its head a little bit. If there's somebody that early in the process we're kind of serious about, like a real reference from someone who I believe will tell me the truth, somebody that has sat beside them for the 12 hours a day we all sit beside each other when things are working and we're working hard is really important.
On the flip side of a prolific amount of hiring, there have to, at times, be tough decisions about firing. If you have to make a hard decision in regards to personnel, how do you do it?
You know, I think when we're talking about people, it's difficult to have other people involved because sometimes the process of soliciting input actually changes the environment for the person you're trying to evaluate, and that's not fair. So as lonely as it is, sometimes you got to make those decisions. I think we at HPS, we have the luxury of having a really long tenured cohesive group at the top. So certainly, like, talk with Scott about things, both Scott's with Pranima. But ultimately, those decisions, I think you've got to make them, you've got to wear them, and then you've got to do them. The way I think about it is that ultimately, my greatest responsibility is to this business. And having said that, hard decisions, I then can make them as kindly as possible. But if the decision is particularly with a person that we need to move on or they need to move on, if I believe that's the right long-term decision for the business, I owe that to the other people in the business to
that's
make
right.
that hard decision and then do it as kindly as possible.
Interesting. You brought up the human capital aspect of your job, and you have functionally a dual role. You are the chief investor of a whole pool of capital, but then you also manage a large group of people. And in my experience in our line of work, the Venn diagram of people who are really good investors and really good managers, there's sort of a thin sliver in the middle. Like, they are different skill sets. And you've got a great track record and a great reputation on both sides. How do you do that? Do you have to prioritize one or the other? Do you find one easier than the other and so therefore you have to work on the other side?
Yeah.
How do you make that all work?
My philosophy is that if I want to hire great people, we all do, but I also want people to have a lot of, frankly, dignity in their job. And I want to treat them as adults. And if you hire really good people and treat them as adults, I just made both parts of that job easier.
Yep.
And look, it's possible somebody tries to take advantage of that, in which case they don't deserve to be in that system. And yeah. then we'll deal with that.
Well, and it's your point, then you got to hire the right people.
That's
and it
right.
comes back to, you know, a core skill set of being good at that.
It's really easy to be a good chief investor when people are bringing you really good options to choose from. It got a lot easier.
If I'm a young officer who's thinking about making the move to the private sector, or if I was a young finance professional who wants to grow into your kind of career, what advice do you give them? How do you get from point A to point B?
So two very different paths. But I think on the young officer, I think the path of, first of all, you need to go get the skills. So I think the overlap in my answer is first go get the skills. And I think the skills are a function of repetition. And that was actually one of the things I questioned about large cap private equity. I didn't feel like I was honing my judgment skills because the feedback loop was so long.
Yeah.
You know, you work on maybe
and
you make
a good year, you do 1 year. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then you do 1 year, and then 5 years later, you know whether you're right or not.
That's right.
And so you would be a very senior person and maybe have 4 data points because the first couple don't count. You were just processing.
Yes.
It had to be things where your judgment was part of the decision to do them or not, where you helped shape the diligence process and shape the conclusion, which doesn't happen earlier in your career.
I mean, in a funny way,
what
you and I both do is in the middle because there's, you know, hedge funds and equity-focused places where you have immediate feedback, you know, like the quarter happens
right.
And you know if you got it right or not. We don't have to wait 5 years in what we do, but it doesn't happen in a day either.
That's right.
You know, there's actually a funny middle ground in there.
And I actually sought that middle ground out explicitly because I think it's difficult to sort out the signal versus the noise in daily feedback on the hedge fund side.
That's right.
And I think, one, we make a lot of investments a year. You know, we'll make between 20 and 30 investments a year. And most of those investments, we know whether we're right or wrong within 2 years. And that, I think, is frankly, it's a very interesting, pleasant place to be in the investing spectrum.
Last work question, sort of. I can attest personally you have a great family and 3 lovely children. And I know I wrestle sometimes with work-life balance. You're as busy as anybody I know. How do you make it work with your 3 kids and being able to prioritize them as well?
Well, as you know, it helps having a great wife. That's my first suggestion.
Always a good start.
Have a great partner.
Yeah.
That facilitates everything. Over the past year, starting in 2018, and this is very minor and it shows maybe how unbalanced it all is at the end of the day, I've tried to make at least one decision every week where I actively deprioritize work and make a work sacrifice for family because I know the family makes sacrifices for work every day. And it's amazing how challenging that was because I think we're all trained that, you know, work is urgent, work is important, go do it. And I think that is actually very healthy. And just making one explicit one decision in that direction.
Has a knock-on effect.
A knock-on effect of balancing a little bit. And I think that's good. I think we've also tried to institute like some times where that are inviolate. Like we have now tried to do family dinners and they usually end up being Fridays, Fridays and maybe a Tuesday. That's been great. But you can't overemphasize. I think the partner
has
to start there.
All right. Well, let's move on to our last segment of the podcast, something we like to call best ideas. So in our line of work, you often think about sizing a position or an investment depending on how good of an idea it is. Only good ideas make the portfolio, but investment can be small, medium, or large size based on whether it's a good, better, or best idea. So with that framework, in this segment, we talk about our best ideas outside of work. Mike, you're our guest, so we're going to ask you to go first. What's your best idea?
So my best idea, and this is a recent one that I've tried to implement in 2019, is trying to make email work for me instead of me working for my email. And that's taken 2 forms. One, you can actually turn off on your computer the little you've got mail thing that dings, which I find incredibly disruptive when I'm trying to do work of any depth. And 2, I've tried to make email sending and receiving a more scheduled thing. So I'm trying to check my email once an hour on the hour, and I'll spend 15 minutes on it. But in the intervening 45 minutes, I actually try to generate intellectual capital instead of just responding. And it's been very productive.
That's the most military approach to email ever. Once an hour on the hour. Bells go off and you're
And in the meantime, I thought you were going to say that's why you don't answer my emails anymore.
That's also an issue.
Yeah.
Well, then let me offer my best idea. And I'm actually going to give a recommendation you gave to me once that I very much appreciated. I was going on a long flight for a vacation and I told you that I needed a book recommendation. And you said, have you ever read the books of Don Winslow? And I said, no. And I found them utterly fascinating. So Don Winslow, American author, wrote 2 books, Power of the Dog and Cartel, that are mostly about the Mexican drug war. And what makes them unique, they're fiction, but they're incredibly well-researched fiction. He spent 10 years getting as deep as possible in this. He is an incredibly engaging writer. These books are 500 or 600 pages long, and you fly through them. And they're simultaneously incredibly entertaining and just horrifying. And it's timely and interesting. And actually, I believe both have been optioned. They're going to be made into TV shows now. So my best idea this week is Don Winslow's books, Power of the Dog and Cartel.
So with that, Mike, thanks for coming on the podcast today. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Colbert.
Thanks to our guest, Mike Patterson. If you want to learn more about him and the work he does for us at HBS, take a look at the links in the show notes. And thank you to our listeners. We appreciate you all tuning in. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Check out the show notes to find links to some of our best ideas, and remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. We'll be back next week with a new episode, but in the meantime, please rate and review us on your favorite podcast app.